think they will let me live in Montana?
I would think they'll let you live wherever you want.
Then I will live in Montana. And I will marry a round American woman and raise rabbits. And she will cook them for me. And I will have a pickup truck and drive from state to state. Do they let you do that?
Yes.
No papers?
No papers. State to state.
It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
Good morning, slaves, and welcome to another edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine, where we hate conservatives and liberals alike. I am your host, Stimulator. And doesn't it seem like the end is nearer than we think?
Now believe me, if I thought there was any evidence at all that drilling could save people money who are struggling to fill up their gas tanks by this summer or this year or even the next few years, I would consider it. But it won't. So today we're announcing the expansion of offshore oil and gas exploration.
Old Testament, Mr. Yes. Mayor. Real wrath of God type stuff.
Exactly.
Fire and brimstone coming down from the skies. Rivers and seas boiling.
40 years of darkness, earthquakes, volcanoes.
The dead rising from the grave.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
While Obama and his pals from Booty Poop Shooters, or BP, took a massive dump on the Gulf of Mexico, and the racist settlers from the state of Arizona were figuring out new fascistic ways to keep the brown man down, peeps the world over were getting together to challenge the already collapsing power structure. In LA, over 100,000 peeps flooded the streets to send a clear message to Arizona Governor Jan Brewer and the rest of the numbnuts from the Arizona legislature.
We didn't cross the border! The border crossed us!
On Cinco de Mayo, I was sent a trailer for the new film Machete, produced by Austin filmmaker Robert Rodriguez. We have the script, and everything that's in the trailer is here, and more. And it's worse than I could even imagine.
Meanwhile, the rulers of Fortress Europe are trying to save their imaginary Ponzi scheme, the economy, by putting the squeeze on the Greeks.
This is a crime for the Greeks. The government must find ways to obtain the funds and treat the people.
Greece is part of the group of European countries that are being forced to cut government programs in order to save the euro. These are Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. Or pigs. Yep, it would be pretty ironic if the pigs were the ones who took this whole system down. Yeah, I know, that was pretty f***ing bad. As we have seen during the past few years, the Greeks don't like to be f***ed with. And as expected, Greek citizens got together and took part of a candlelight vigil. Yeah, I'm just f***ing with you. Once again, thousands attempted to storm the parliament, while others set all kinds of things on fire, including cops. Unfortunately, the firebombing of the bank resulted in the death of 3 bank workers. Yep, the class war can get messy, but the accidental death of the Greek bank employees has received a disproportionate amount of coverage by the turd-nibbling mainstream media who want to discredit the resistance, while giving wimpy-ass pacifists more fodder for their weak and cowardly analysis. All this while ignoring the state-sanctioned murder of Betty Cariño, a freedom fighter from Oaxaca, Mexico. Betty was gunned down by pro-government paramilitaries while conducting a fact-finding mission with other human rights activists. Here's Betty in December of 2009.
Es necesario, pues, hermanos, hermanas, mujeres, sobre todo.
It is necessary, brothers and sisters, and especially for our women, who are on the forefront of the home, on the forefront of the fields, and on the forefront of the land, to recognize our strength, the mighty strength that accompanies us, to tell the government that we are confronting right now, that we are not afraid, and that we will never fear them, and that the time of the people, the indigenous people, is at hand.
And finally, just in time for Nakba, a punk motherfucker, illegal Israeli settler, shot and killed a Palestinian teenager in the occupied West Bank. Israeli settler violence has been on the rise, and this is just the latest in the long history of Zionist brutality against the Palestinian people. But more on that after the break. As a way of remembering Nakba, I dedicate this song to all my Palestinian peeps.
While we listen to tunes made by ignorant fools, Israel blocked the UN from delivering food. They bring in the troops and you won't even glimpse of the news. They make money off the products that we're quick to consume. And it's not simply a question of differing views. Forget emotions, this is facts, what I spit is the truth. Makes no difference if you're a Christian or if you're a Jew. They're just people living in different conditions to you. They still die when you bomb their schools, mosques and hospitals. It's not because of rockets, please God, can you stop this all? I'm not related to the strangers on the TV, but I relate, cause those strangers could have been me.
Imagine if you were gangsta chilling in your home, and some motherfuckers forced their way in, and told you you cannot live there anymore.
It's my house!
Now imagine if those same motherfuckers said you could set up camp in your own backyard.
You get the out!
But you had to ask for permission if you wanted to leave, or come into the house to take a shit. And these same motherfuckers control the access to your food and water. What the fuck would you do? Now, imagine if this happened in North America on a larger scale. A bunch of foreigners forced themselves into the land, kicked inhabitants off their homes, and gave them tiny pieces of land to live in. If this was happening today, most red-blooded barbecue sauce-loving Americans would pick up their Smith & Wessons and take care of biz. Well, this type of f***ed up situation has happened already in many parts of the world, including North America, and through mankind's history. It's called colonization. One of the most recent examples of this practice happened to the Palestinians. To find out more about the conflict between Israel and Palestine, I spoke with Professor Rami Zuraik. Hey Prof, how the f*** are you?
Okay.
So, Palestine versus Israel, what's the big f***ing deal?
I'll start that the initial idea drove the invention of Zionism and the creation of the state of Israel, the state which is a self-declared state for the Jews, that is for a certain group of people and not for other groups of people. And I think this has to be traced to the centuries of anti-Semitism that has been prevalent in Europe and in most of the white world. At the end of the 19th century, a group of people led by Theodor Herzl got together and decided that they were looking for another nation, a place where the Jewish people could establish a nation. They looked at various ideas, Argentina, places in Africa, and eventually thought that it would make some sense to establish a Jewish state in Palestine. Then, of course, people also driven by anti-Semitism in Europe starting coming and settling in Palestine, but small numbers of people. And these, because Palestine was first under Ottoman rule, and yeah, that is under the Turkish Empire at that time, and then Palestine, historic Palestine, was then under British mandate, and eventually, after, of course, the horrors of the Holocaust, then the more and more an increasing number of Jewish people made their way into Palestine. The problem, of course, is that unlike what has been presented to the Jewish people themselves and to the whole of the world, this was a land where there were people. There were people called the Palestinians. This was not what people say, that this was a land without a land without people, for a people without a land. This was a place where there were people who had been there cultivating the land, being farmers, being traders, being merchants. They had their cities. And the problem was that this was, for the Zionist movement, this was something that was not acceptable. The Arabs, the Palestinians, had to be expelled from Palestine before the state of Israel could be created, and this is what they set on doing.
Former commander and shit Jimmy Carter published a book called Palestine, Peace Not Apartheid. Is Mr. Peanut Farmer Man correct?
Sure. I think apartheid is a very mild way of putting what goes on and what has gone on in Palestine. Apartheid is the division of rights, of geographic space, of between people, where some people get more rights than others because of their ethnic appartenance, their ethnic belonging, because of the color of their skin in South Africa. Zionism is much, much worse than apartheid. Zionism has got, apartheid is part of mild Zionism, but Zionism stands for the replacement of a people by another people. The expulsion of a people and its replacement by another people who has no links with the country in which they are inhabiting. Under South African apartheid, the black people were placed in Bantustan. In Palestine, the Zionists expelled forcefully through massacres, which we remember every day, because today, this time is the time when we remember the Nakba, the great disaster that has struck the Palestinian people. And there was a movement of expelling them, through scaring them, through committing murder, massacres such as in Tel Yassin. And this is very well documented in the world of Zionist historians themselves.
Can you break down for me how life is for Palestinians in the occupied territories?
Palestine is, of course, divided into two places. The place that is currently called Israel, which is what we call 48 Palestine, which is the land the great part of the land that has gone to the Zionists when Palestine was partitioned by the United Nations. And in there, of course, you have people who are called Israeli, who have Israeli nationality and who are Jewish, and people who have Israeli citizenship and who are Arab. And these two identifications are clearly reflected in their identity papers. And if you are an Arab in 48 Palestine, you're not allowed to study the same majors that somebody who is not Arab can study. You are not allowed, for example, to hold many jobs, because many jobs require you to have military service. And the Arabs, who are, I repeated, 20% of the population today, more in a few years, are not allowed to hold these positions because they do not go to the army. There are also in other forms of discrimination, like, for example, being refused access to live in the same neighborhood as people who are not Arab. There are Arab neighborhoods and non-Arab neighborhoods. Now, in what is known as the occupied territories, which we call the West Bank, these are territories that are occupied. That is, even if you recognize the state of Israel, the Israelis themselves have to recognize that these are occupied territories, illegally occupied, in which there are settlements that are constructed illegally every day in clear breach of all international laws, and where you have roads that are for settlers and roads that are for the Arabs, where you have water wells that are for settlements, and small springs where the Arabs can hardly and barely get their water from, and where the lands are divided and are under occupation, where the Arabs, which are in occupied, their own occupied lands, cannot circulate freely.
On the international scene, the Amazon nuclear power facility has blown its stack, irradiating the world's largest rainforest. Environmentalists call it a disaster.
But don't they always?
It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
Good morning, slaves, and welcome to another edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine, the show where banks make for warm fires. I am your host, the Stimulator, and as the 20 gangsters of the industrialized world get ready to split up the global pie in Toronto this June, a group calling itself FFFC allegedly sets fire to a branch of the Royal Bank of Canada, or RBC, in Ottawa. According to a communique posted on Ottawa in the media, the FFFC are f***ing pissed at the RBC for their financing of the
motherfucking tar sands
and their sponsorship of
the Five Cock Rings of Death
in Vancouver, and said in their statement that they will be in Toronto during the G20 meetings this summer. This last part has made cowardly social democrats and so-called progressives, who have been attempting to pacify the upcoming protests in Toronto, throw a hissy fit and side with the pigs and the mainstream media in their condemnation of this brave act of economic justice in which no one was hurt. But more on that after the break. Speaking of gangsters, a group of over 100 freedom fighters took to the streets to oppose the G8 University Summit in Vancouver. Similar to the G8 and G20 meetings, activists say that the G8 University Summit is a closed-door meeting where higher education pimps discuss plans to further privatize colleges and universities. The troublemakers then block the bus containing the edupimps for over 30 minutes before being brutalized by the Vancouver pigs. Six peeps were arrested during the scuffle, but no one was charged. In news of the NGO industrial complex, a coalition of environmental groups signed a deal with the devil with logging companies that will allegedly save a chunk of the boreal forest about twice the size of Germany.
It's our best and last chance to put in place world-leading forest management practices that we can be proud of here in Canada and which we can be an example to around the world. And it's our best and last chance to create a sustainable and healthier forest industry in Canada.
I guess your best is not good enough. Critics say that in reality, the agreement only saves an area about the size of Toronto, and that it prevents environmental groups such as Greenpeace from criticizing or creating protest campaigns against logging companies in the future. To top it off, the agreement left out indigenous groups out of the negotiation, i.e., the peeps who have been kicking it in these lands for over 10,000 years. Here is Clayton Thomas Mueller of the Indigenous Environmental Network.
The entire framework was negotiated between environmental NGOs represented in this coalition and the forestry sector. Meanwhile, in places like Grassy Narrows, Temagami, Barrier Lake First Nations, these communities continue to have their lands decimated, by companies like Weyerhaeuser. We have to be cautious about the fact as well that this agreement is a precursor to a forest offsets program here in Canada, which commodifies the boreal forest and turns it into a commodity to be bought and sold on carbon trading markets to offset developments like Canada's tar sands and the mega mining explosion that's taking place across this country.
In San Juan, students have occupied two campuses of the University of Puerto Rico, one of them for over a month. The students are mad because the government of the U.S. colony has cut over $100 million from the public university. The pigs have surrounded the main campus, but peeps have been launching food and water over the fence, and the students seem to be well stocked in order to make this a long battle. The students say they draw their inspiration from student uprisings in California earlier this year. And finally, in Bangkok, fierce battles between the Thai pigs and the motherfucking Thai resistance, aka the Red Shirt Movement, raged on last month, leaving dozens of red shirts dead. The red shirts used makeshift rockets to attack the pigs and burn tires to camouflage their movements through the city. Thai forces broke through the barricades and took back the red shirt encampment. But the battle is far from over. The Red Shirt Movement is strong in many parts of Thailand, and as the Bangkok rebellion was winding down, the Red Shirts stormed and burned government buildings in the northeast of the country.
I won't stop fighting. I won't give up as long as we haven't had justice, haven't had democracy. Thailand will still be like this. We have a lot of leaders in other provinces.
They killed my entire family, murdered and tortured, raped and pillaged. I was only 5 and I was the only surviving witness. My entire village burned to the ground. He wore a serpent in his crown. Happily committed murder with a frown. And an army of black hooded fiery skull generals. And a sorcerer that can cast spells that'll change your genitals. Held me in slavery till I turned 18. Killed my slave master 5 years later, became king. And I slain dragons and ate steaks during famine. Had the seeds of war planted in a dirty tavern. Had the seeds of presidents killed in a burst of anger. And had their parents bleed to death on the floor of a dirty bathroom. I watched the palaces burn. I seen the ashes of my comrades return to their family in a urn. While a proud child remembers his father that died, the cycle continues with vengeance alive in his mind.
Earlier in the show, I told you about a militant action in which a branch of the RBC went kaboom. Predictably, any time brave peeps try to take to the next level, so-called radicals bring out the same old tired arguments.
The blowback from this action will make it harder to organize. This action takes the movement back 20 years. These people are irresponsible.
Blah, blah, motherfucker, blah. Seriously, these folks act like prisoners in a penitentiary who suck up to the guards to get special privileges while snitching on those trying to start the slave revolt. If they had it their way, these motherfuckers would have us organizing marches and die-ins till the end of the fucking world.
According to my source, the end of the world will be on February 14th in the year 2016.
Valentine's Day. Bummer.
To help us unravel why this annoyance keeps happening, and since we have less than 4 years to go until the whole f***ing thing goes to shit, I bring you Peter Gelderloos, author of How Nonviolence Protects a State. Hey Pete, how the f*** are you?
Doing pretty good today.
So, Peter, how the f*** does nonviolence protect a state?
Basically, the idea is that, well, especially in North America, pacifists and nonviolent advocates have had a very defining role and even a censoring role in determining what other people's participation can be in a whole range of social struggles, and that the way that they've affected social struggles has made it very much easier for the state to control those social struggles. That nonviolence plays a function of recuperating social struggles, of taking out their teeth, making them harmless, so that they can just exist in this sort of cesspool of democratic plurality, in which everything is okay, nothing can really be challenged or changed, and ideas, opinions can be expressed infinitely without ever having any real impact, without really translating into action. A lot of times people will justify nonviolence, making the very common sense, very simple and ultimately false argument that violence is the government's strong suit, and it makes no sense to fight the violence of the government with violence of our own. And what they're doing is conflating very, very different activities. They're suggesting that somehow defending yourself against police violence or destroying commodities or taking over property, fighting to free prisoners, indigenous people fighting to take over stolen land, things of this nature, somehow has any similarities with governments carpet bombing villages or using landmines or police torturing people or putting someone in prison. That just because by some linguistic coincidence these different things can be described as violence, that somehow there's not only similarities between them, but that they're the same thing and that one is going to reproduce the other. When in fact, by fighting back, people actually raise the stakes of repression and oppression for the state and actually make real short-term differences, and I think also have a greater potentiality of ultimately destroying the state and capitalism and helping us create those worlds that we want.
Why is militant resistance celebrated throughout history? Like, for instance, the American Revolution. But when it happens in the present tense, it's discouraged.
I think it's because the left, to a large extent, subconsciously, has as its primary role to make resistance harmless. States have recognized that resistance will never disappear, that struggles will never disappear. And in the past, they tried suppressing struggles the first time that they showed their heads, that there's any sign of them, and that proved ineffective. So nowadays, the way that states rule is by accepting the inevitability of conflict and resistance and just trying to manage it permanently. And the best way to manage it is to also have people in the resistance who are managing it for you. And that's really the role that nonviolence plays, and it's really encouraged by the media, by various dominant political discourses, that the state is allowed to use violence, but people who are rebelling, people who are angry, people who are trying to attack the system, are aggressively isolated, slandered, bad-mouthed, punished if they ever use violent tactics.
From the burned-out shell of an Ottawa bank in a quiet family neighborhood come loud cries of condemnation against the self-proclaimed anarchists who blew it up. If blowing up this bank is advance notice or a way to boost the ranks of a murky anti-globalization movement, it may have backfired.
There's been a wave of criticism coming from even other special interest groups.
On the same website, other activists call the firebombers everything from idiots to domestic terrorists who've crossed the line. too radical.
The mass of protesters in Canada don't support violent activity to start with, but there will be a minority that sees this as an inspirational message in order to carry out further violent acts.
And so in this way, the state and the media train, especially more professionally minded activists within the resistance, to enforce this code of nonviolence so that they never incur that loss in popularity or that bad press. And this creates a self-policing function that, and people who are sort of politicians of the movement are more susceptible to it because they're thinking often in terms of their own careers.
Give me some examples of how militant actions have helped the motherfucking resistance.
The revolutionary anti-racist action in the Netherlands. So we're talking about a very bourgeois and democratic society, a wealthy society, and also this was... this was a group that was active in the 80s, so relatively recently, the 80s and the beginning of the 90s. And they participated in a broader movement against Shell Oil Company, specifically demanding divestment from South Africa. So this is part of larger anti-capitalist struggles and anti-racist struggles that had along their path certain goals that they wanted to achieve. Certain things that they were fighting for more immediately, and so this this group, Revolutionary Anti-Racist Action, actually carried out a number of bombings and sabotage campaigns against Shell, and were successful in winning that divestment, in forcing Shell to pull out of South Africa by causing them such immense amounts of damage. Also in the context of many other tactics, including informational campaigns and boycotts and protests and all these other things, working together had a very strong effect.
Thanks, Peter. And that about does it for this edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine. A triple cheese whoop whoop with bacon to the following slaves for keeping this pulpit of vulgarity operational. Gordon, Audrey, Britton, Maureen, Joao, Michael, Stephen, Vincent, Sakura, Edwin, Jim, Peter, Michael, Rodney, Matthew, Dan, Bella, Carlos, Anastasios, Ryan, and Rhea. Hammerific. I'd also like to let y'all know that I have uploaded a new piece of my upcoming film, AntCiv, on AntCiv.com. For links to militant actions or to comment on this show, just visit my website, stimulator.tv. Now, go out there and smash pacifism.
Remember, kids, you can podcast high-quality video of this show at submedia.tv.